We'll call the meeting back to order. Representative Wills moves House File 3867. Representative Wills, you have an author's amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions on that? Otherwise, Representative Wills moves the A18-0637 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 3867 as amended before us. Two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this issue was brought to me by a constituent who was concerned that the current tax for the motor vehicle sales tax or excise tax has not been updated in the past 30 years. So the last time it was changed was in 1985. And so the value of a vehicle that currently is $3,000 or less is charged a $10 fee, and anything over that value is charged the 6.5% sales tax. So what's changing here is increasing it to $4,000. So then if the value of the vehicle is $4,000 or less, they would only be paying that $10 fee instead of the 6.5%. So the calculation that we used to come to that number was the consumer price index based on what it should be if we had updated it after 30 years. So I'd like to also explain the amendment was simply to clarify, because when I was reading it, when it says does not have a resale value of $4,000 or more, it can get a little confusing with the negative in there. So working with the revisor staff, the amendment simply makes that language more clear. This would be of greatest benefit to individuals who own cheaper vehicles, which tend to be lower-income Minnesotans, and would save them some money. So that is the bill in a nutshell, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. And members, just so you know, the motion will actually be to move it to, I believe, Transportation Finance.
Yes, sir.
So this will not be laid over. We'll be actually voting on the bill itself. So is there anyone in the audience wish to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns on the bill? Would the department like to testify? Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so with that, questions for members for the Wills bill, House File 3867 as amended. Okay, with that, all in favor say aye. Or would you like to wrap it up?
I would appreciate your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way to Transportation Finance. Thank you, Representative.
Thank
Item
you.
Next is 3598, the Olson bill. We're very fortunate today to have Representative Olson with us. And I do see an amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, it is.
Okay, so Representative Schultz moves House File 3598. Representative Schultz moves the H3598A1 amendment. So we're voting on the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank me. It passed. So with that, we will go. Now we now have House File 3598 as amended before us. If you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What you have in front of you is a bill to provide a tax exemption for building materials for the Duluth Central High School. And I'm actually just going to keep that really brief and turn it over to the testifiers here to share a little bit more about this.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we get going, is there anyone else wishes to testify for the bill with concerns? The department? Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so with that, now I got to think for a second. Duluth East, Duluth Central, and is it Denfeld or Field? Denfeld? Is that Denfeld. Those are the three, right?
Right.
But they're not all currently open.
No.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids and distinguished members of the Tax Committee. I'm Bill Gronseth, Superintendent of Duluth Public Schools, and with me is our school board chair, Dr. David Kirby. We're here in support of House File 3598, which provides incentive for private development of the former Denfeld, or former, don't tell Denfeld I said that, former Duluth Central High School through exempting redevelopment construction materials from sales and use tax. So during a community-wide development for long-range facilities plan, Duluth reduced the number of schools at all levels and identified some sites to be sold. We have sold several of those sites. We are left with two. Duluth Central High School is a 77-acre site in Duluth. It's one of the largest developable pieces of land in the city. It has an amazing view, which is on the back of the handout. Unfortunately, yours isn't in color. Amazing views of the city. Private redevelopment of this site would really provide an opportunity to meet our demand for housing in the community, encourage new businesses, generate jobs, and increase the tax base for not only the school district, but the city and the county as well. There is a development on one of our other former sites, was Woodland Middle School at the time. It is now a very, very productive area of housing and businesses, and we believe that the central site could do a very similar thing for Duluth and really connect our downtown and our hillside. And Chair Kirby, if you want to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kirby.
Dr. Kirby.
Only my children have to call me that. thank you.
I would suggest that you get a new artist. Or maybe just take it at night, I suppose.
Thank you,
Dr. Kirby.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Private developers have expressed interest in this central property, and in one case even signed a purchase agreement for the property, but the significant infrastructure challenges proved too costly. This bill, we feel, could be the tipping point in helping private developers address infrastructure challenges that are related to the site and proceed with development in a very cost-effective way. As a school district, we are not in the development business. We have to go to other governmental entities like the City of Duluth and St. Louis County for helping to make these properties attractive for development. Passage of this bill would be a concrete benefit we could provide as a district to potential developers that would help substantially in marketing this property. We would continue to work jointly with the City of Duluth as well as St. Louis County. And this would go hand-in-hand with state assistance. The bill would go a long way to help selling the property to a private developer, and this would benefit the city of Duluth as a whole, as Superintendent Grantz has mentioned the Woodland property did. So we respectfully urge you to support this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about it, and we would answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kirby. And members, you should have a photo or an artist rendering during the daytime now. You should have that. Now, was it Duluth East that had the state championship in basketball in 1969 and their center was a 6'9" Como Pontliano? Does that ring a bell?
Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that question, Chair.
Okay, I mean, he was just awesome. I think he was East. Questions from members? Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the testifiers or for staff, what is the current sales tax rate in the City of Duluth right now?
Maybe Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the general local sales tax rate is 1% added on top of the state tax rate of 6.875.
Chair Garofalo.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Ms. Dalton?
I'm sorry, as Mr. Michael pointed out, I left off the St. Louis transportation tax, which is also a half cent.
So, Mr. Chairman, staff, it's
835?
8375.
Chair
Grapple. I just changed it to 835, so Rubis is wrong. So, okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, with that, questions for the testifiers or the author? Okay, with that, would you like to wrap it up, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thanks for the support of this bill. It's something we've worked closely between state, county, and school officials, and I'm happy that we're here having this conversation, and thank you for the support.
Thank you very much. So with that, Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 3598 as amended be laid out for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Superintendent. Thank you, Doctor. Now the crown jewel of today's meeting, other than the other bills, would be I will bring back House File 3411. Oh, we have previous amendments on that. Okay, I think Mr. Cummings, is that in the packet here? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cummings. And just to refresh members' memories for a little bit, I do have a list of folks that have questions. So as we get into this, I will go down that list first, and then any other questions we will take up. So I will move House File 3411 be before us. I will now move the A180661. What does that do, Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, we will describe that within the context of the larger bill.
Okay, so I'll move the A18-0661 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended before us. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please. And what we'll do is we'll take some more testimony on the bill here, but I think there's some folks that have driven in to testify on some provisions. We will want to get them in today. So is there anyone in the audience that when the department is done talking about this wish to testify for the bill or with concerns? Oh, we've got a couple here. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. So they are either for it or have concerns, and it is the department here today. So with that, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson from the Business Partnership said that because this is the third time we're hearing the policy and technical bills, that it might be like three strikes and you're out. But I have to say, Mr. Chair, I think it more likely is third time's a charm. So we'll see how that goes. Mr. Chair, at the previous committee hearing, we had worked through Articles 1 and Article 2, so I think that we'll start off with Article 3. We understand that testimony will be taken after this on any parts of this bill. Mr. Chair, Article 3 deals with partnership tax. Now, you know, the main attraction being the state fair at county fairs, you know, there are many members of 4-H and FFA that really work to develop partnerships to build a better state and county. Now, this obviously is talking about different types of partnership, but I was hoping to draw it back to the larger theme. Maybe it's still not working, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings, do you take care of Farm America in this?
Mr. Chair, that I think that was already taken care of, but maybe not.
Okay. Mr. Cummings.
So with that, Mr.
We're on
Chair.
Line 8.14, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Mahony will be going through Article 3 of the Partnership Tax.
Mr. O'Mahony. There we go. Mr. O'Mahony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is John O'Mahony. I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. To give you a little bit of larger context, the thing that this article addresses is a change in federal law that was made as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. It's a complicated piece of federal legislation, so I will just give you some large picture things that need to be addressed in state law. And the major two things that are done differently in the federal law than what has been done in the past is that partnerships now will, in certain situations, be receiving assessments for additional unpaid taxes from the Internal Revenue Service following an audit. That has never been the way that has worked before in prior years. It has always been that the IRS might investigate a partnership in the way that it reports its tax liability, but then goes down and assesses additional taxes from each constituent partner following a determination of liability. The second important change that's made in federal law is that the IRS will now be splitting what is called the reviewed year from the assessment year. In prior years, after an investigation is closed, the assessment always relates back to the year in which the tax liability should have been reported by the taxpayer. Under the Bipartisan Budget Act, there is now an assessment year that can be in the future. So those are the key differences in federal law that need to be addressed in state statute for various reasons. And with that, I will take you through the major components of Article 3 here. The sort of two big picture things to think about in Article 3 are that we are addressing these changes about federal partnership law, and the way that we're doing that is by revising the state's RAR statute. RAR stands for Revenue Agent Report. This is the thing in the state procedural statute that requires all taxpayers, not just partnerships, to report changes to the Minnesota Department of Revenue following an Internal Revenue Service audit when there is an assessment or if the taxpayer files an amended return with the Internal Revenue Service reporting an additional liability or making a refund claim. So the first thing that should stand out after you get through Sections 1 through 4 is that there are 21 new definitions added as part of this article. These definitions are codified in a new section that is in front of the state general RAR statute as they relate primarily just to partnership adjustments, but there are some general definitions in here that also relate to the reporting of general liabilities following adjustments by the Internal Revenue Service. We think that there's some good new clarity here, and we've worked with some national interested parties in the development of this legislation. Specifically, I would point you to the new definition of final determination date. This clears up an ambiguity that's existed in the state's law for a long time and has also existed in some other states. We're also adding a definition that contemplates a new type of federal adjustment report that we think will provide uniformity between Minnesota and some other states after other states have passed legislation like this and should ease some administrative burden for taxpayers. But primarily the new definitions that you're going to see here relate to specific types of partners and specific types of partnerships, and those definitions are really to facilitate writing a statute that contemplates reporting for complex tiered structures. And with that, I will go through the sort of substantive provisions of the article. That's going to start at 15.23 for people who are wanting to follow along in the legislation itself, or at Section 6 here in the summary. This portion of the article replaces what is currently at Minnesota Statute 289A38 Subdivision 7. That is the general requirement that taxpayers report an adjustment by the Internal Revenue Service to the state of Minnesota. What you're going to see here is that the wording is a little bit new, and that is because it doesn't have to be quite as dense because of some of the defined terms that we now have. But what you're going to find is that taxpayers are generally required to report a change by the IRS to the state within 180 days of the change, or the final determination date, and that is in general when the taxpayer no longer has appeal rights as to the federal assessment. That is not substantively different than current law, same time frame, same reporting requirement, and the same is true when an amended return is filed by the taxpayer with the IRS. The last paragraph of that section provides an exception to the general reporting requirement, and that is for partnerships that have these partnership-level audits that I mentioned earlier. That is going to be a narrow subset of relatively large partnerships. In general, partnerships with more than 100 partners are able to opt out of this new audit system. What we've heard from the business community is that they expect that the vast majority of partnerships with less than 100 partners will do that. So the assessments that we expect to utilize this new reporting system contemplated under the following section are going to be large and probably highly tiered partnership structures. With that said, I will go to Section 7, which is codifying a new section at 289A383. You're going to notice there that there is a contemplated state partnership representative. This is something that also matches the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. This is going to be the person that is going to be able to make binding decisions for the partnership as to state tax matters. It's generally going to be the same person as the federal partnership representative, though they will be able to name a state partnership representative if they so choose. The next two subdivisions get to the substantive reporting requirements for partnerships that do have entity-level assessments. What you're going to see here is that there's basically a two-track system, and you're going to have a default and then also an option. The default is going to be that basically partnerships are required to do what they're required to do under current Minnesota law, which is when there is an adjustment made at the federal level, they will, within 180 days, report those changes to their direct partners. Within 90 days, they will also file amended composite income tax returns. A composite return is something that the partnership files. If its non-resident partners don't wish to file Minnesota income tax returns, the partnership can pay that part of the liability for its partners. And they would have similar requirements for the related type of withholding returns for non-residents who do wish to file their own returns. So the default system is that if the partnership gets an assessment, it will act as an information reporting conduit that's similar to the way that partnership law has generally always worked in the state. I also mentioned that there is a second track here, and this is an election that the partnership will be allowed to make at the state level under Subdivision 3, starting at line 17.14. If the partnership makes an election to pay the liability at the partnership level, they will, within 90 days, file a federal adjustment report with the Commissioner of Revenue, and after 180 days, they will go through an eight-step liability calculation where they will figure out how much the partnership should owe at the state level. And I'm not going to go through each of those steps individually, but the reason that there are multiple steps is because the partnership needs to look down at all of its direct members and indirect members and determine the residency status of folks who own an interest in the partnership, either directly or indirectly, figure out how much each of those folks owe based on whether or not they're residents or non-residents, and then also look at each exempt member who might have unrelated business income from the partnership, and then also looking at each corporate partner or pass-through partner and determining what the appropriate apportionment percentage for each of those members is, and then basically combining all those things together, calculating the tax liability, and then paying that to the Commissioner of Revenue. What you'll see as part of the amendment, and this is consistent with the national model that's been developed in this area, is that there is an exemption here that you're not allowed to make the election if you're reporting an adjustment that's made after an administrative adjustment request or if you have a unitary corporate partner. And that is because there are concerns about the way that apportionment would work in those situations, that we might be opening up a planning opportunity for folks to use the election. And so in those two areas, things are not allowed. The fourth subdivision provides that for each entity that is in a tiered structure, so if you can imagine a partnership that owns another partnership that might own a trust and then their individual beneficiaries, if the top partnership chooses not to make the election and they act as an information reporting conduit, the second partnership down the line can still make the election to pay at the entity level. And we want to make sure that this is possible just because in each tier, a partnership management might decide that they would like to, utilize the election in order to ease administrative burden, basically. Each time you go down one of these tiers, it requires a lot of information reporting both to the state and to individual partners, and then each of those individual partners has a filing obligation following that. So a lot of times we find that partnerships can save money by just saying, hey, we'd like to pay you. We also passed something out of this committee and then also in the omnibus tax bill last year in 289A35 that allows partnerships that are under audit by the state to petition the state to be assessed at the entity level instead of acting as an information reporting conduit, just because it saves them a lot of administrative burden and money to just pay at the entity level. Rather than to go through the entire information reporting process. We do contemplate that that change from last year will work in concert with this election. Taxpayers can make the election if they have all the information necessary to report their liability to the state. There might be cases where they can't gather all that information, but they might still be able to approach the corporate tax division under the entity-level assessment program passed into 289A35 last year. And if they can demonstrate that it's in the state's best interest to accept basically a consent to change at the entity level, the department has the power to accept those petitions. And so we do want to just highlight that as something that we expect to work in concert with this. The last couple of things that I will mention as revisions to the state's RAR statute is that we've made some changes to the statute of limitations extensions, both on assessments and for refund claims. There are two extensions, and neither of these are to the general statute of limitations, either on assessment or refund claims. But as part of the current RAR statute, there are extensions. There's one that extends the statute of limitations on assessment when there has been an RAR change. And the way that this works now is that If there's an RAR change that's timely reported, that's within that 180-day period by a taxpayer, that is going to open up the statute of limitations on assessment, but only as to those federal RAR issues at the state level. That is something that we worked with interested parties in the state on, and we came to agreement on the limitation to that issue. And then also the new model will provide that the statute of limitations on refund claims will be open for the same period of time that the statute of limitations on assessment is open, which is a change from current law. We think that it provides a lot more clarity and fairness to taxpayers. It's something that we worked with the local bar on and also the taxpayer rights advocate inside the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And we think that that is a good change that people will be happy about. There are also a variety of conforming changes, as noted in the summary, and that's sections 1 through 4 and then 10 through 15. Those are corrections to cross-references. As you can imagine, the RAR statute is cross-referenced at several different instances throughout the administrative chapter. So those are corrections related to the other changes, and that concludes Article 3 of the policy bill.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Throughout this process, this is something that happened within a federal bill. It is an item in which we are trying to ensure that the state tax code works well within the constructs of the federal tax code. And to do that, Mr. O'Mahony has worked well with the Multi-State Tax Commission, the American Society of CPAs, as well as the American Bar Association. And we have also worked with our local partners at the Business Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Society of CPAs, and other practitioners to try and get this to be in a place where it works well. Even as recently as yesterday, we have made continued updates, which is reflected in our amendment at the request of business groups, to ensure that we are trying to get to the right amount of tax and it is appropriate for and supported by many of the people that would be subject to this. So we have been working very hard to make sure that this is a piece of legislation that can be broadly supported.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. O'Mahony from members at this point? Okay, thank you, sir. And for the record, Como Pontliano played for Duluth Central, not East. Yes. Just to correct it. Okay. Okay, so that being said, let's go to, we have several folks who would like to testify. Mr. Carlson, would like to start us out, and we'll just, I see a show of hands for who else would like to testify. Why don't you all come up and sit at the table so we get you all. And whether you're for the bill or concerns with it, we'll listen to what you have to say. If you could please start us out, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson, and I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Travel Tech, which is a online and hardline travel intermediary company, and I've appeared before you several times on their behalf on this particular issue.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Appreciate you taking some testimony again on this issue. The concern, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to direct your attention to is on page 7 and 8, of the bill. And just a brief little bit of background. In the 2011 special session, the tax bill included a new service that was subject to sales tax in Minnesota, and that service was accommodation intermediaries. And while we were disappointed to be the subject of a tax increase in that bill, we did work with the Department of Revenue to figure out how we could comply with this new requirement. And while the legislation imposed a sales tax on our accommodation intermediary service, it never amended the local lodging tax. And in fact, you've never amended the local lodging tax. And just kind of set the record straight and help us understand this transaction and how it works. Mr. Cummins said when the last time we heard the bill that these companies resell the rooms and they're not paying the tax on the full price of the room. And that just doesn't happen. You can't resell something that you don't own. and these companies never own a room. All they do is assist in the reservation system that hoteliers and resorts and other properties make available. The accommodation intermediary never owns the room. And so what we do is we facilitate the booking, and we pay a what we've worked out with the Department of Revenue, we pay directly to the state a sales tax on our service. They also said that this just isn't transparent to the consumer, and I just stayed in downtown St. Paul for the high school hockey tournament. I was sad that my Spuds weren't in it. But I have my bill in front of me. I paid $189 a night for a room in downtown St. Paul. On my bill, it tells me exactly what I paid for taxes. I paid $163.24 in taxes, and I paid $12.99 to Priceline for facilitating that transaction. It is clearly transparent. It's right on the bill.
How much are you paying taxes on that?
I paid $163.24.
In taxes?
In taxes on my room for four nights in downtown St. Paul.
Four nights, okay.
Yep. I stayed for the whole tournament, even though.
The Kelly's cheaper than that.
As I said, it was $189. So clearly disclosed to me as a consumer what it was that I had paid. And so there's no tax avoidance. The full amount of lodging tax on the full price of the room is paid, as it should be. But the Department of Revenue provision now would say that local lodging taxes that are collected locally would now impose a local lodging tax, and there's about 120 of them, and they all have different rates, on these service fee for travel intermediaries. And that's just not online travel companies. That's tour groups. That is VRBO. It's anybody who arranges travel. And we would now become local lodging taxpayers in every single one of these jurisdictions if they choose to send us a bill for it. So they might be able to find Priceline, but there are hundreds of these travel accommodation intermediaries. And so they can select the few that they want to send the bill to, but they won't do it to everyone. And what I fear the most of all of this, because I'm here in front of committees frequently promoting tourism, is that it would be very easy for an online travel company to just simply disconnect a facility or a lodging establishment in a small community because the risk of tax compliance is just too great. And that's what I really don't want to see happen. I want to book those bed and breakfasts in Lanesboro and other places. But if all of a sudden I have a local lodging tax liability risk, which, by the way, the effective date in this goes back to confirm the original intent of the legislature, which Representative Lesch first introduced in 2010, you're exposing these companies with this effective date to back tax liability as well, and we have very much concerns about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson from members? Okay, the next person, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shane Rudlang, and I represent the Bloomington Port Authority. Some members may have heard me on this issue before as well.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here to discuss the local lodging tax issue that some areas of the state collect and the current statute. As we've heard, it allows online travel companies to not currently charge the local lodging tax on what is commonly referred to as the booking fee, which is the delta between the sale price and what the room is sold for at a wholesale rate. And we have a hotelier here from our city who can go into that in much more detail. They know it a lot better than we do. Lodging taxes can vary depending on how a guest books a room, where they pay as well. Online travel companies such as Travelocity and Orbitz-based local lodging taxes on the wholesale amount of the room, and not the retail amount that the customer sees on many websites. Mr. Carlson was an example where that is separated out, and many websites is not. Whereas the guest books a room through an official hotel website or other traditional methods like on the phone, the local lodging tax is paid on the full listed amount. The result is slightly lower tax revenue and sometimes an overall reduction in the total amount paid for the lodging, and it's very inconsistent on how this is applied, and it puts local Minnesota businesses at a disadvantage. The Department of Revenue settled a suit with the online travel companies in the last couple of years related to this issue. There's some confusion as to whether the lodging tax and sales tax are applied to the same base. In some situations, that's not the case. In some situations, it is. There's a lot of confusion related to this particular issue. Bill House File 427 last year was included, well, its companion was included in the Senate Omnibus Bill in 2017. It didn't make it out of conference committee. As to the discussion about resorts and wedding planners and whatnot, if we don't believe there is an issue there, but we'd be happy to have a conversation about that to make sure that there isn't an additional burden put on those. And in addition to the potential retroactivity of the bill, we'd love to talk about improvements to the bill if that's sought. And with that, I think that'll conclude my testimony. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Questions for members for Mr. Lang? Okay, to the final gentleman, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Sackerman. I'm the general manager at the Embassy Suites in Bloomington.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members as well. I don't want to speak against the online travel agent. I've been in the business for a lot longer than they have. But they brought a real good to our industry. No doubt that they've generated a lot of guest rooms for us and throughout the country. But there has been a disparity. If you dial the clock back, when they first came online, we started selling a lot of rooms through the Internet. Expedia is obviously a very well-known channel. I took advantage of it just like all of my colleagues in the business, and it paid dividends. But then there started to become a very significant disparity between what the hotel was selling and what you could get on Expedia.com. So my brand website was advertising a $100 rate for that same room, same night. You could go to Expedia and get it for, $85. So over the years, the hotel brands have brought rate parity between the OTAs, or they stopped working with them. And it has been, I think, successful over the last few years. And the marketing arm that the OTAs offer is very important. But now, many of the OTAs are using the tax as a way to offer a discount. So, in other words, if you go on Expedia.com and you look at a room night, the same room, same date, same price, you're paying a little bit less if you book it through Expedia and you select the pay now option, because then that transaction all goes through Expedia and it comes back to the hotel at a rate less than what we were advertising. That's not fair. I mean, that's basic common sense. The reason we wanted parity with the OTAs in the first place was, it wasn't fair selling the same room, same night, at two different prices. So we wanted to stop that. And now in our business, it's really, 15 different ways to book a hotel room at my hotel. You can call me. You can call the hotel direct. You can go to our website. You can go to Hilton's website. You can call the 800 number. You can go on, you can call your travel agent. And every one of those channels, every one of those sources are going to charge the rate plus tax. It's going to be exactly the same except for the OTCs. And that concludes my testimony. If there are any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions for members? Okay, with that, thank you very much. And so... Oh, Mr. Carlson, anyone else like to testify on this? Does the department have any further comments? Or? Okay. Well, Carlson's not done yet. So.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Our members developed a policy about 2 years ago in support of the language that's currently in the department bill, and so we wanted just to get on the record saying we do support clarifying the application of the tax to the whole consideration for the hotel room. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Carlson. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but my question would be for the department and Paul Cummings.
Okay, any questions for any of the folks who just testified here? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Let's go back. Mr. Cummings should come forward. And I've actually got, this is where I go back to my list. I said I'd keep a list. I did. And actually, we're going to start at the top of the list, and you're on the list.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson. I can't remember what my question was from the other day, but I'm sure it was important. Representative Hertaus, do you have any? Okay. Representative Erickson? Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. I knew you'd get to the best, Eric. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, from testimony yesterday, I just want clarifying questions about what I think I heard you what you said in regards to the lodging tax. First of all, a little comment. Before session started, I was able to get to Arizona for a few days to get some warm weather, and I got the air ticket breakdown back for the airline ticket, and the airline price was one thing, and down below were all the taxes and fees. It actually surpassed the cost of the airfare itself, which is just kind of an issue for me in regards to how we are really taking the tourist industry and making it tougher for people to have vacations. But in regards to what I think I heard you say in regards to the lodging tax, if it's on the bill that the hotel has, then everything that's on that bill would be eligible for the lodging tax. Is that what you said?
Mr. Cummings?
Yes, so it's the entire consideration, which would include, you know, these sort of other ancillary services. That would be the tax base for the lodging tax.
Representative Petersburg?
The follow-up with that is then I'm aware of a lot of restaurants that are in hotels. And so if a person who is staying at the hotel decides to go to the restaurant and eat lunch there and chooses to use his credit card at the restaurant rather than assigning it to their bill, they aren't going to be charged this particular tax. But if they were going to charge it to their hotel bill, it sounds from your interpretation that they would pay the additional tax because they've already would be assigned the sales tax. So am I correct in understanding your interpretation?
Mr. Cummings?
I'm going to ask Ms. Berry to respond.
Ms. Berry, to the Petersburg question.
Yes. Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Berry with the Department of Revenue. Representative. Certainly for the general sales tax, it really doesn't matter, right, whether it's the tax is a lot on the lodging or whether it's from the restaurant. Either way, it's going to be taxed the same, right? As far as a local lodging tax, if you're looking at the total consideration, I mean, some of the related services would include things like room service or room delivery, including the mandatory tips and gratuities, that kind of thing. Whether or not, if you were charged for the restaurant itself, that wouldn't be subject to the lodging tax unless the local ordinance had something specifically in it that would state that would be subject to lodging tax, and sometimes they do.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it looks like in regards to what we heard earlier, not everything that may be on your bill could be charged the lodging tax. Is that now a modification of that understanding?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know whether it's a modification or not, but to the extent that the hotel is charging you for things that are not related directly to the lodging, you know, that would be something that would be on the bill, then, you know, it wouldn't be subject to the lodging tax.
Mr. Lang, would you like to weigh in on this one? To the Petersburg question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Shane Rudlang again, Bloomington Port Authority. To answer the question about what is the local lodging tax applied to, I asked our collectors in-house after the hearing last week to get clarification on that. And the answer is, of course, sales tax is applied to all of those items. If you're ordering if you're down in the restaurant, you're going to pay sales tax and any food-related or beverage-related taxes if they exist, but not the local lodging tax. So in-room services, if you do order an extra bed or an iron, if there's a charge for that, that would be applied, but not for a gym membership. There was some discussion last week about those types of things. That's not local lodging tax, only in-room services and the room itself.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's getting clearer than mud, but I appreciate that. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
I just wanted to note that I think that it's as this is a provision that deals with the local lodging tax, but this discussion of these sort of other ancillary services or connected services is not connected with this bill. And I know when we talk about the lodging tax, these are some of the questions that come up, but I wanted you to know that we're not, this is not, none of that will be changed under this provision.
President Petersburg. Yes, Chairman Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings. This, my question has been something on my mind for several years. I've had small businesses come into my office and where they maybe travel from one city to another and with their businesses. And would it be safe to say that businesses, when they collect taxes, that they're actually working for the state?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, the sales tax,
yes.
Is a tax that is, people pay businesses, and then businesses do collect and then remit that tax to the state. So businesses are do play an essential role in collecting that for the state. So, we certainly thank many of the people that have to collect and remit sales tax as part of their business structure.
Chairman Detmer.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sure you send thank you notes to the businesses. I'm just being funny, but it is a serious thing. Would you say that probably for some businesses it costs them money to send taxes to the state?
Mr. Gumbel.
Mr. Chair, as with any sort of person who is a taxpayer, whether it's an individual income tax, sales tax, corporate tax, you know, in terms of making sure that people are compliant with the tax laws or any laws, that does take additional. Many times, it does take additional resources to do that. I would also say this is that there is a competitive disadvantage for taxpayers if they are collecting and remitting the sales tax according to state law, and their neighbor or this online retailer is providing the same service or the same item that a consumer sees, but then they have to pay a different rate of tax. And in this case, what we're seeing is that Minnesota-based hotels or services are at a competitive disadvantage due to the tax. And so in this case, we're not saying should the tax be more or should the tax be less. I think that's – and those are valid discussions. I think Representative Petersburg, brought up a good point to say, are there too many taxes based on the things that are traveling? We have car rental fees or other types of things. Yeah. But in this case, this is about ensuring that people are paying the same tax regardless of where they're paying or where they're asking for the room from.
Yeah. Chair Denver?
Just to, clarify, I'm talking about a small business that – and they're able to figure out the amount of tax that has to be sent in. We'll have to hire somebody to figure that out. And so there is a cost to that business. Has the state ever thought of maybe allowing a percentage of the tax that's collected to maybe stay with the business to give them incentive to get the tax turned in on time so they're not late? Has that ever come across? I know I had a piece of legislation that would allow that. So.
Mr. Cummings?
I'll say I'll say two things. First of all, we have, there have been various bills that have come up about providing allowances to people who collect and remit tax, and we have talked about how that would work. We've talked about various thresholds, one threshold for small business, another threshold for larger businesses, trying to make sure that smaller businesses have a larger sort of allowance. Those have not passed in recent years. But those are something that we've worked on. And I'll also say this, that the cost in terms of collecting and remitting this tax is really borne on many of the local taxpayers who have to pay this tax. because the people that we're talking about that are getting to pay the tax at a wholesale rate rather than the consumer rate, these are these online travel companies. So who are the people that we're asking to pay the same rate of tax are not the hometown, you know, Holiday Inn. These people are the online travel companies. So
thank you. And thank you, Mr. Cummings. It's an issue probably, I would say, more so for small business and not your larger businesses, because it's a cost that business have to eat to do the business of the state to make sure that they get their tax, because if they don't get those turned in on time, they're penalized and so forth. So just a comment. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings, do the hotels voluntarily let out these rooms through intermediaries? They don't have to do that, do they?
Mr. Chair, I think the decision in whether to let them out is a decision from the hotel. I'm not sure if they should be told that they can't let out these because they're not being charged, you know, the taxpayers aren't being treated equally, or that the online travel companies are not paying the full cost of the lodging tax on these rooms. So,
you know, it begs the question, do the benefits outweigh the so-called uncompetitiveness in the situation? My thought would be that a lot of rooms are rented out that probably wouldn't be otherwise. Just a thought. Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to quickly respond to Representative Detmer's question to you, Mr. Cummings, in regards to the small businesses being partners with the state. We are, as a small business person, we collect the sales tax and pay to the state, and we oftentimes a business will get a tax exemption when we purchase our goods that we sell back to our clients and customers. So there is a little bit of an advantage as a business owner where we see a sales tax exemption at the point of purchase on some of our items. But in essence, we are definitely a customer or a business partner. As Commissioner Bowerly was in our committee a couple weeks ago, called the taxpayer customers. And as business owners, we are part of that business. We're helping collect a sales tax. So there are some advantages. I think that it would behoove probably the commissioner and the department to maybe just be better business partners in the appreciation of us collecting the sales tax for the state. Not that they're not, but seldom is heard. I've been for 30 years, I've been collecting the sales tax and paying to the state. Fell seldom late. I think we do it quarterly now or monthly. But if you are late, boy, there's a penalty and a fine and a slap on the wrist, which is probably appropriate. But again, we are part of a business partnership, aren't we, in collecting that sales tax. And it does cost us time and money. So I would echo Representative Detmer's bill, if he wants to put it up again, of small percentages maybe staying within that company or a small business to help them offset the expense of collecting and remitting the sales tax to the Department of Revenue. Thoughts, Mr. Commissioner? Commissioner. Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Representative McDonald and Mr. Chair, well, I know that you have a photography business, right? And we surely do appreciate the contributions that you make and many of the people who do collect and remit the sales tax across the state. So if we haven't said it enough, we'd like to say thank you and thank the many other business owners in the state.
And now it's on the record.
And Mr. Chair, I'll also just say this in terms of talking about managing many different rates across the state. I think this committee and the tax committee passed 10 new local option sales taxes last year. One of them was for I think a sanitary district, you know, in West Lake Mille Lacs, and I think in Senator or Representative Erickson's district.
Is that Kathy?
That's not my part.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to.
Representative Lewick, I think.
Representative Lewick. But I think, you know, as we're many, there are many people that have to manage quite a few different rates across the state in terms of how things are collected. So we have quite large confidence that our online travel companies would be able to find the rates and then ensure that the tax is being collected and remitted according to the law.
Any other questions on House File 3411 as amended? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to respond to Representative McDonald's comments about being business partners. When I go and buy a hunting or fishing license at the hardware store or at one of the big retailers, that issuing agent is a partner with Minnesota in that they're able to retain or keep a small fee for their work or effort in doing that. We recently have heard testimony about the deputy registrars when they're issuing license plates, they get to keep a fee. But for the most part, largely businesses are not partners. They're involuntary trustees who must collect this tax. They have to handle the money. They have a fiduciary responsibility that's imposed upon them, and there's severe penalties if they don't comply with that. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on House File 3411 as amended? Would you like to wrap it up since it's the department bill, Mr. Cummings? And thank you, Ms. Berry. Thank you. Well, Mr. Cummings.
Are we done?
I guess I got it. It's my bill. I should wrap it up.
Well,
when smart courts know it's Reese's bill.
This is a, Mr. Chair, this is a fine piece of legislation.
Fine piece of legislation.
We appreciate the committee and the opportunity to have a hearing. Again, we wanted to reiterate, Mr. Chair, that if people have items of sort of note or concern that are brought up in this bill, we look forward to talking through those issues and discussing with them. And of course, we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, as this bill continues to move along.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, for all your work on this bill. So I'll renew my motion to House File Number 3411 as the amendment be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Next meeting tomorrow, March 21st, 10:15. We have House File 917, Appeal Bill, 2508, a Fenton Bill, and 3093, an Erdahl Bill. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.